Christianity is about facts. When we open the Bible and when we read in the Gospels the life of Jesus Christ, when we read about his birth, when we read about his teaching and about his miracles, when we read about how he went to Jerusalem and died on a cross, we are reading history. Historically verifiable accounts, eyewitness accounts, corroborated, carefully researched by the gospel writers, we're reading facts. And there is one fact above all other facts that you can trust your whole life to, your whole future to, for this life, for death, and for what lies beyond death. It's the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. The accounts that we read in the Gospels are historical records of people meeting Jesus after he rose from the dead. So let's read the encounter which a woman called Mary Magdalene had with Jesus Christ, and it's recorded for us in John's Gospel and in chapter 20. So I'm going to read this section from John 20. I'm reading from the NIV. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, that's a code name for John, and said, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they have put him." So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. But Mary stood outside the tomb crying. And as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They've taken my Lord away," she said. "I don't know where they've put him." At this, she turned round and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who are you looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." Isn't that wonderful? Don't you just love that? That's one of the most amazing sound bites anywhere in the Bible. Just that what Jesus says, her name, Mary. And she turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic. That was the language that was widely spoken in Palestine at that time. "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I've not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I've seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. Isn't that phenomenal? And as those of you who have been Christians for a number of years will know that story and you'll think you know it off by heart. Well, I can assure you there's a lot in it that perhaps you hadn't thought of. Mary Magdalene was a picture of devotion to Jesus Christ. You bet she was. It says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark. I mean, how many of you just hate getting up in the dark really early in the morning? It's horrible, isn't it? Mary was really devoted to Jesus, and she was up before dawn on the first day of the week. Why? Well, she wanted to go to the tomb and do what she hadn't had the opportunity of doing. Jesus had died on the cross horribly on the Friday. And as it was getting towards the end of the afternoon, a man called Joseph of Arimathea and a man called Nicodemus had taken down the body, prepared it for burial, and buried it in Joseph's own tomb. Mary had seen this, but she had not had the opportunity of doing what she wanted to do, which was prepare the body herself for burial. So as a devoted follower of Jesus, she was there. She was off when it was still dark to get to the tomb as quickly as possible to do this. She was really devoted to Jesus. She's a picture of devotion. Now, let me ask you a question. Why was Mary so devoted to Jesus? Was it just kind of a feeling? I feel devoted. Was it just kind of, well, she was believed she was devoted? Mary was devoted because of what Jesus had done for her. Luke's Gospel, the 8th chapter, we read that there was a time in Mary's life when she was under the control of 7 devils. And we don't know what form that control took, and there's no point speculating, but we can certainly be sure from what we know about what devils are like, that this was a time of darkness in Mary's life. It was a time, a destructive time, a downward spiral. Her life was falling apart at that time, and she met Jesus of Nazareth, and he delivered her. And because of that, she was really devoted to him. So her devotion was born out of what Jesus had done for her. Has Jesus done anything in your life? Can you identify with his experience? Maybe not the 7 devils thing, but a time when your life was falling apart. It was a downward spiral. And then Jesus came into your life. Are you devoted to him? Is there evidence? Well, there was evidence in Mary's life because her devotion was born out of what Jesus had done for her, and her devotion translated through into action. Mary and some other women used their own personal money, possessions, whatever it was, to meet the needs of the disciples. They maybe paid for food or clothing, or perhaps they arranged accommodation with their friends. We don't know exactly what they did. But it says in Luke 8 that Mary used her own personal resources to show her devotion to Jesus. Would anyone know you were devoted to Jesus? Is there evidence in your life? Or is it all me, mine? I keep my own stuff. And she was devoted, and there was evidence of it. And her devotion continued because she followed Jesus around on his teaching ministry in Galilee, and then when he went south to Judea, she was there with the other disciples. She considered herself a follower of Jesus, one of his inner core of disciples. I'll say something about that later because it's really important. She was there at the cross. She saw the horrible scene unfolding when her beloved Jesus was taken and beaten and mocked and spat upon and whipped and hung on the cross and he died. And then it was getting late in the afternoon and the body was taken away and she didn't have the time to do what she wanted to do. Her devotion was right to the end. It continued. Mary was a picture of devotion to Jesus that we would do well to emulate in some degree if Jesus has done anything for us. So there she's a picture of devotion. But very quickly, she becomes a picture of distress. Mary Magdalene went to the tomb. She saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. And she drew the conclusion that somebody had taken away the body of Jesus. She couldn't find Jesus' body. So her distress was caused by her inability to find Jesus. Even the dead Jesus, she couldn't find him. Where was he? And it really cut her up badly. Have you ever been in that situation where, you know, you're looking for Jesus? I'm sure a lot of you will know what I'm talking about here. There's been a time in your life when your prayers have gone, or you felt it like this, they've gone no higher than the inside of your skull. You know what I mean? Not even as far as the ceiling. They're just bouncing off the bone. You think them and you're praying them quietly and they're going nowhere. Maybe they do get to the ceiling, but they don't get any further than the ceiling and it's so dry and you want the Lord, but you just can't get through and it's just awful. It's such a distressing experience. Or perhaps you would class yourself as a seeker. You know, you're in church and you know, most people in the city are not in church. You're here in church this morning because you're looking for something. You know, you're not satisfied with your life. You're just seeking something beyond yourself, something meaning, reality, purpose. And you've prayed and you've maybe even done an Alpha course already and you're maybe thinking of doing another one or something and you just can't find the one you're looking for. Isn't it such a distressing experience. You know, where is he? Lots of people have been through that experience. People in this building, people whose lives are recorded in the Bible, David, Job, and so on, all looking for the Lord. She was really distressed, and her distress came from the fact that she couldn't find Jesus. But her distress was aggravated, I think, by two things. One of them was wrong thinking. Is this not where it all comes off the rails? You're coming into church this morning, and she didn't speak to you on the way in. Why did she not speak? She's avoiding me. She really is avoiding me. It must have been because of I jammed her car in the car park last week. It must have been because I bumped into her child in the hall. She's not. Look, she's not avoiding you. She's looking for somebody else. Okay, she just didn't see you. So just chill out about it, okay? It's a corny example, but it's just like wrong thinking. We get wrong ideas, and then we begin to work out everything on the basis of our wrong ideas, and we get totally messed up. Mary's wrong thinking was this. Listen to her conclusion. She says, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb. Well, who are the they? I don't know. Who? Well, just they. You know what it's like? They're to blame. How often do we say that? It's them. I wish they would fix the road. Well, who are you talking about? Them. They did it. Not otherwise specified. Maybe she's thinking of Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea. Other people who've taken the body away. They have taken the Lord out of the tomb. And as this was the framework in which she was thinking. Somebody must have stolen the body. No other explanation. You notice what's missing? The possibility, just the possibility that something supernatural could have happened. That something amazing could have happened. One of the astonishing things about the accounts of Jesus' resurrection is the difficulty which Jesus' followers had in accepting the obvious. Jesus was telling them over and over and over again, I am going to be handed over, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to rise on the third day. Even his enemies got that message because they went to the Romans and said, that deceiver said, he's going to rise on the third day. Let's seal up the tomb in case the disciples steal him. His enemies got the message, but his followers didn't. And she was thinking within this framework of wrong thinking, well, there's only one explanation. Somebody's stolen him. Even though Jesus had been saying, I'm going to rise, I'm going to rise, I'm going to rise. Even the Pharisees who hated him got that message. Didn't get the rest of his message, but they certainly got that bit. Wrong thinking. Oh, that's where it all goes wrong. When it comes to matters of Christianity, maybe you're one of these people and you think, well, you immediately dismiss the supernatural. You live in a world where everything is predictable and scientifically verifiable. There's no room for the supernatural. Well, you're immediately excluding a realm of reality, which is the supernatural. You're saying, oh, dead people don't rise. Who says they don't rise? You don't believe they rise. The Bible teaches that they do rise. Jesus was seen by eyewitnesses after he rose from the dead. Wrong thinking. Oh, beware of it. That's where everything goes off the rails. So her distress was aggravated by wrong thinking. But it was aggravated by another thing. It was aggravated by the total inability of Peter and John to offer any explanation or indeed any comfort. Just read what happened. She ran to Peter and John and said, they've taken the Lord away. Peter and the other disciple, that's John, started running. They ran as fast as they could. John was a faster runner. He got there first. He didn't go in. Peter, hothead as always, straight into the tomb. They saw the linen clothes lying there. It was just like, this is not a scene where grave robbers, for example, have been in. Grave robbers don't carefully unwrap the clothes, lay them down, take the body away. Anyway, why would grave robbers go? Jesus said nothing at the end. Nothing. He's not going to be buried with a bag of gold. So what's the point? It just didn't look like a scene where that had happened. They looked in, they saw and believed. Verse 9 says they still did not. They believed that the tomb was empty. They believed that the grave clothes were folded. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. They still did not get it, even at this point. And then I think this is a Verse 10, the more I think of this, I think this is a terrible indictment of Peter and John. Verse 10, the disciples went back to their homes. They went home. They left Mary. Mary had, in distress, had gone to get them for help. They came, they just looked in, it was just like, we don't know what's happened, and they went home. they couldn't didn't say anything to Mary. They didn't like give her a hug and say, well, we don't know what's happened, but we're with you in this. They said, well, it's past breakfast time, off home we go. And they just left her there. Now, I'm kind of making fun of Peter and John. It's not fair, really. They're not here to answer for themselves. But her distress is aggravated by the inability of others to help. They couldn't even be there. And sometimes the best thing that you can do for somebody who is suffering in some way is just to be there. You may not have the answers, but just be there with them. Let them know that you're in that experience with them. Peter and John couldn't even do that. And that must have made Mary's distress even worse. So she starts off as a picture of devotion. She very quickly becomes a picture of distress when she finds that the stone's been rolled away, the body has gone. So what do you think's next? There's no explanation. The guys can't even be there. She's left completely on her own. She's in free fall. What's the next D, you think? Despair. Is this not a picture of despair? They say a picture is better than 1,000 words. And what do we have here? The disciples went back to their homes. Verse 11, Mary stood outside the tomb crying. Is that not just a heartbreaking picture? Mary is a brokenhearted woman. She is despairing. She doesn't know what to do. Her friends, the ones she trusted, Mary, Peter and John, can't do anything. Jesus, he's been taken from her so cruelly. You know, it was just the sham of the trial, the horror of the crucifixion, and now the body is gone. She can't even do what she wanted to do for him. She is a broken-hearted woman standing there, sobbing by the tomb. She is the only person who shed tears at the tomb of Jesus. Do you know that? And she is broken-hearted, in despair. But the amazing thing, and I don't want to dwell on this bit in case I have you all reaching for your hankies, that's not the idea. Because the sermon's not supposed to be kind of gloomy. You're thinking, oh, this is getting worse. She started off as devotion, she's distressed, she's in despair. Where's the light going to come from? No. Because the amazing thing is that Mary, at her lowest point, was closer to a transforming encounter with Jesus Christ than she could ever imagine. And as I was thinking about this, I tried to come up with some kind of phrase that would maybe stick in your mind. And I don't know if this will do it, but try this one. In the mysterious geometry of the grace of God, it's often when we're at our lowest that Christ is nearest to us. In the mysterious geometry of the grace of God, it's often when we're at our lowest that Christ is nearest to us. How do I know that? I know that because Psalm 34:18 says that the Lord is near to who? To the brokenhearted. Is that the way you feel just now? Do you feel that, you know, everything has fallen apart? You have no hope. Well, Psalm 34:18 says that the Lord is near to the brokenhearted. And this story tells us, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Mary at her lowest point was actually much closer to Jesus than she ever imagined. I believe at this moment in Mary's experience, which I think was probably the lowest, I don't know if you agree with that, but I think this must have been worse to Mary than the seven devils. At the time of the seven devils, she'd never known Jesus. But then to be delivered, to experience the light of his love and his grace and his power and his presence, and then for that all to be snatched away with no hope, that must have been worse to her. And yet, Jesus was closer than she could ever, ever imagine. I believe he was invisibly present at this moment, watching her crying, just standing there. She didn't know he was there. So let's go on. That was Mary as a picture of despair. She's just about to become a picture of, this is where it gets great, delight. The rest is all an introduction, so the sermon just starts now. Okay, this is the bit you've all been waiting for. She becomes a picture of delight through a transforming encounter with Jesus Christ. So let's carry on with this. She's there at the tomb. And I think I tried to identify four kind of dimensions of this transforming experience. And here are the four for you. The first is she has a new experience of Jesus. New experience of Jesus. The experience, first of all, is born out of her darkest moment. As I've said, she was really at her lowest point here, and yet it was in that situation that Jesus revealed himself to her in a new way. So don't despair. Psalm 34:18. Go and look that up. Memorize it. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. You feel brokenhearted, Jesus could be nearer to you than you ever imagine. So her new experience of Jesus came from her darkest moment. But her new experience of Jesus, I love this, verse 12 says, she saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. Her new experience of Jesus involved the ministry of angels. Peter and John had gone, so the Lord sent two angels. Isn't that great? Peter and John were useless, so the Lord sent two angels. Angels are an interesting subject. I don't want to digress here. Whatever you do, don't do an internet search for angels. You'll get all kinds of weird tripe. But what the Bible says is, and it's a kind of an interesting kind of little summary of what angels do. It's in Hebrews 1:14. I think it's 14. It says that angels are ministering spirits sent forth by God, in brackets, to minister to those who are receiving his salvation. So that's the main function of angels. I know there are angels like the seraphim and things that we're singing about that worship God. That's their main function. But there are angels whose main function is to minister to those who are receiving God's salvation. Is that you? Are you one who has believed in Jesus? You're receiving the benefits of it. Well, the angels are there to minister to you, and they're here to minister to Mary. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So these two angels speak to her. They obviously didn't freak her out, and Mark's gospel talks about a young man. So I think the angels probably just looked like nice young men in white clothing, and they were sitting there. They say to her, "Woman, why are you crying?" And why did they ask her that? Is that really cruel? "Woman, why are you crying? You tell us." No, it wasn't like that. Of course not. There are lots of reasons you can ask questions. You can ask questions to imply the answer. You can ask questions to get information. Or you can ask questions because you know what the answer is. It's like, you've got the picture of angels, nice young men, white t-shirts, and so on, all the rest. Well, here's another part of the picture I imagine. I visualize the angels with a slight kind of sort of half smile, twinkle in their eye. They're saying to Mary, "Mary, why are you crying? Woman, why are you crying?" Have you ever been to pantomime? You know, when the main character is saying, "Where is, you know, so-and-so?" And all the kids in the front row say, "He's behind you." "Where is he? Where is he? Where is he?" And there's this huge thing standing right behind you. "I can't see him." I sometimes visualize the angels like that. They're kind of looking slightly past her, and they're just itching to say, "He's behind you!" Isn't that a wonderful picture? The ministry of angels here. They say, "Woman, why are you crying?" They say, "Well, they have taken, now it's not the Lord, it's my Lord. It's my Lord. They've taken him away, and I don't know where they have put him." And this said, she turned around. Why did she turn around? I think it's because the angels are kind of maybe looking slightly past her. "He's behind you." She turned around, and there's a figure standing there. So her new experience of Jesus came from her darkest moment, involved the ministry of angels. It also involved her inability to recognize Jesus. He's standing there behind her. She turns around, sees this figure, and she instantly assumes that he is the gardener. It's dawn. The gardeners are kind of trim the grass and trim, you know, they don't open tombs and remove bodies, but she, her wrong thinking is still kicking in here. She assumes he's the gardener. And this person says to her, get this, "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" There's something really wonderful here. These are the first words that Jesus spoke after he rose from the dead. He spoke to his broken-hearted follower, Mary Magdalene, and he said, "Woman, why are you crying?" Now, just think of what Jesus could have said. You're writing the script of the epic blockbuster movie that's going to be the biggest grossing movie of all time about the resurrection of Jesus. Where does Jesus appear? He appears in the high priest's palace. And the high priest is just shaving or whatever it is in the morning, and suddenly, boom, there is Jesus in all his glory. And he says, "I am alive." Is that not what you would write in the script? Here's Jesus, the creator of the universe, the sustainer of the universe, the Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the ending. And what is the first thing he says after he rises from the dead? "Woman, why are you crying?" And that, to me, is one of the most powerful insights into the heart of Jesus for his followers. Forget the high priest just now. We'll deal with him later. One of my most faithful followers is here, brokenhearted. I've got to comfort her first. That is just amazing. Just think about that afterwards. Talk about that over your Sunday lunch. What an insight into the heart of Jesus. "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" She didn't recognize him, thinking he was the gardener. "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I will get him." And then Jesus said to her, "Mary." So her new experience of Jesus came from her darkest time, involved the ministry of angels, involved her inability to recognize Jesus. It was intensely personal. If you're going to be transformed, it's great to come here in all these people singing and so on, but you need a one-to-one with Jesus. You need Jesus to meet you personally and transform you. If you are a Christian and you want to move on to a higher level of your Christian experience, and what you need is a one-to-one with Jesus, an intensely personal encounter with Jesus Christ. And that's what she had. So that was her, she has a new experience of Jesus. Okay, we better move on swiftly with the last three things are going to be very quick. She has a new confession of Jesus. Now, I'd like to preach 10 sermons on this verse here. Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic. Now, Aramaic was a form of Hebrew that most people in Israel at that time spoke. And this is left untranslated in the Greek New Testament. It's left in as the Aramaic word. And what she says is, "Rabboni." And what Rabboni means is, "My great master." And this was a term that was used only for the highest, the most dignified of Jewish teachers. And what is happening here is that this woman, who's been under the control of seven devils, has been released by Jesus, is one of a small and elite group of followers of Jesus who consider him, the great rabbi, Jesus of Nazareth, to be their great, personal, supreme teacher. This is, it doesn't sound, you're saying, well, what's he, I don't know what he's talking about. In the culture, that is utterly revolutionary. And to me, this is a window into the new order of things that Jesus is instituting, where it's not an issue of gender or of race or of age. It's an issue of people transformed by Christ, meeting Christ, serving him out of the giftedness that he has given them, out of love and devotion. This is the new community. This is the church that he is building. If you don't believe me, read Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost when all of these things are blown out the window. All of these things that we get so hung up about. There's, I sense, 10 sermons coming on here, so we better move on to the next part. She has a new confession. "Rabboni." Never called him that before. "My great master, my great teacher. My great teacher." Isn't that wonderful? So she has a new confession. Then she has a new relationship with Jesus. Verse 17, Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me. I'm not yet returned to the Father." She's clinging on to him. Are you surprised? She never thought she would see him again. Never thought she would even see his body. She's clinging on to him. And he says, "Okay, let me go just there, Mary. Don't hold on to me. I've not yet returned to the Father. I've not yet returned to the Father." So what's he saying? He's saying, "Mary, the time and the place for unbroken fellowship with me is not here just now. That time will come. John 14, I go to prepare a place for you. Where? In my Father's house. That's the place, unbroken fellowship. I wanted to assure you, you're a Christian this morning, that is what is up ahead, unbroken fellowship with Christ in the Father's house. But just now, yes, we can experience fellowship with Christ, but not that unbroken way that we will then. Now there's work to do. So she has a new relationship with him. He says, don't cling on to me just now. There'll be a time for that. There'll be a place for that. But just now, as my sister with my brothers, go. There is work. So the final thing, so her new encounter, her transforming encounter is a new experience of Jesus. She has a new confession. She has a new relationship with him. Finally, she has a new ministry for him. He says, go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord. So you can imagine, she's not just, I've seen the Lord. It's, I've seen the Lord. I've seen the Lord. She's a picture of delight. She's been transformed by her encounter with Jesus Christ. She has a new ministry for Christ. That is, and I didn't make up this term. It's been around for 1,500 years. She is an apostle to the apostles. She goes with the message of the resurrection to the apostles. And if you read the book of Acts sometime, you will discover that the core of the message of the apostles was Jesus is risen from the dead. And the person who lit the blue touch paper of the explosive apostolic ministry that we find in the book of Acts and beyond was Mary Magdalene. She went back to them and said, I've seen the Lord. He's alive. And I want to assure you that Christianity, although it involves feelings and beliefs, is solidly based on facts. The greatest fact is that Jesus Christ is alive. And he wants to meet with you, and he wants to transform you. Do you want to meet with him?